From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings. Summer 1987 marks the bicentennial of the Constitution of the United States. How well do Americans know their principal governing document? Two replies to that question this week on Soundings. First, a conversation with Michael Kamen of Cornell University, followed by a discussion with Joyce Appleby of the University of California at Los Angeles.
Here we have a document that presents us with a curiosity. People know about it, but they don't know about it. Are the American people ignorant of their Constitution?
They are, and they have been ever since the very outset. And in fact, the good news is at least they are less ignorant, I think, today than they were a century or a century and a half ago.
How do we account for this?
Well, there are various reasons. The first, speaking historically, has to do with the oath of secrecy that the delegates to the convention took. There was no press coverage in Philadelphia in 1787, and the delegates were very concerned about the problem of leaks. They felt they'd be able to do their work more effectively if there were no outsiders, and so they essentially made an agreement among themselves that they would not talk to anyone who was not a delegate to the convention about their work. But more importantly, they took an oath, a kind of gentleman's agreement, that for half a century after 1787, no one would publish notes, diaries, journals, an insider's true account of what really went on in Independence Hall, and so on. So in the absence of hard information about the horse trading that had gone on in Philadelphia, Americans were just playing in the dark. Consequently, for example, when the Golden Jubilee of the Constitution came to be celebrated in 1837, it was really a dud, in part because Americans were both ignorant and consequently indifferent. There's a close connection between the two.
Uh-huh.
And the Golden Jubilee was sort of like they gave a party and nobody came. There really wasn't an awful lot happening, and it's closely related to that this first reason for ignorance, namely the absence of hard information about what had gone on in the convention.
What about education? We pride ourselves on our educational systems. That certainly
that's
must have
the
something
second,
to do with it.
That's a second major factor. Throughout our history, the Constitution has been poorly taught when it has been taught at all.
Uh-huh.
It is a document that lays out the structure of a government. It is a blueprint for government, and that's not exactly hot stuff. And consequently, if you want to get human interest into the Constitution, you have to link it to dramatic cases, for example, that have come before the Supreme Court, such as the Dred Scott case or the Charles River Bridge case, or Wade v. Roe, the abortion decision.
Mm-hmm.
There are ways in which you can make constitutional education interesting, but for the most part, until relatively recently, that has not happened.
It has
been taught as civics in a very boring way.
Yeah, as we all remember from our high school classes. Other factors that might account for maybe ignorance is too strong a word. Is it?
It's ignorance, indifference, apathy, a combination of factors, but there's one other very important consideration that I can't emphasize strongly enough and that not much attention has been paid to. And that is the fact that our leaders in public life from the very beginning have almost gone out of their way
not to talk
to neglect talking seriously to the American people about the Constitution. I can give you a couple of very interesting examples, because President Reagan today, in a sense, stands foursquare in a tradition that began very clearly with George Washington. When the Constitutional Convention ended in Philadelphia in 1787, George Washington sent a letter the very next day to the Marquis de Lafayette, his old, close, bosom friend from the War of Independence, and said to him, "Well, we have finished our work, the Constitution's done, and now it's on its own, as far as I'm concerned." I'm paraphrasing Washington's words, I'm not quoting directly. But he says in this letter, dated September 18th, 1787, written from Philadelphia, "Now it's on its own, and if it's good, it'll be successful, and if it's not good, it'll be rejected, but I will not lift a finger, one way or the other, to campaign for it." Now, Washington's prestige, political, moral, personal, was so great that had he actively campaigned in an educational sense? Had he either written essays or spoken at various state ratifying conventions, it would have made it much less of a cliffhanger. As you know, getting the Constitution ratified was very tough. And, of course, in the state of North Carolina, it was particularly tough. But Washington refused to lift a finger. Let's move on to a couple of other examples, though. Thomas Jefferson, in his first inaugural address, said that the Constitution is our text of civil instruction. And from time to time, he would speak about the desirability of constitutional education as a way of making good citizens. But, in fact, he did no more than George Washington, and when he suggested or wrote a syllabus for the new law school at the University of Virginia, his great pride and joy, he totally omitted the U.S. Constitution from the list of required readings for law students.
Isn't this really a good thing in a way that the government hasn't created its own sort of civics PR document, that it makes the high assumption about people learning the Constitution for themselves? Now, as you're telling me, Michael Kamen, people haven't necessarily done that.
They haven't, and they're not likely to, again, because the Constitution is not self-dramatizing. And I think it needs a push. I think it needs educational leadership.
Well, we're back after a fashion, Michael Kamen, to your original observation about the rather sorry state of affairs that most Americans don't know that much about their Constitution. Let's turn the coin over. What does the Constitution tell us about ourselves as a people? We can use a very large phrase like the national character. Is it possible to look at our Constitution, stand it up there all by itself, and extrapolate from it the nature of what Americans are and how they have handled this political experiment? Do we need all these other documents and trappings and contexts that you deal with as a historian?
I think we do. I think the contexts are crucial. I think that if you look at that Constitution or any state constitution in vacuo, it does not tell you very much.
And yet we appeal to it endlessly, don't we?
We appeal to it endlessly, but we generally appeal to it in various contexts. And I think you can only understand what it has meant and why it has worked so successfully by looking at what various people have done. For example, during the time of the American Civil War, or the war between the states, if one prefers, Abraham Lincoln interpreted the Constitution very broadly. Some people felt he violated habeas corpus, that he invoked emergency powers and war powers too liberally. But the great debate of the day was whether or not the Constitution was adequate. And these are the words that they used. Did we have an adequate or an inadequate Constitution to a grave political crisis? Lincoln demonstrated that the Constitution was adequate if interpreted judiciously but firmly in the context of that particular situation. Now, my point is, you cannot understand why it turned out to be an adequate Constitution unless you look at Lincoln and the politics of the American Civil War era, which is why I think ultimately political science without a historical context is meaningless.
Yeah. Michael Kamen, we're talking about the American Constitution. Let me ask you to speculate a little bit here. What might our framers say if they came back in the late 1980s and looked at the American Constitution, looked at what has happened to it and how the American people have dealt with it, treated it, interpreted it? Help me with that.
Well, that's a fun question for a historian, because historians love to play a game called hypothetical history. What if is one of our favorite activities. I think that the founders, if they could revisit the United States today, would not be upset or surprised about many of the things that people think they would be upset about. For example, the existence of political parties. Political parties are not in the Constitution. They do not seem to have been provided for, and yet they emerged almost immediately after the new government came on the scene. And I don't think the founders were surprised by that. Public opinion is obviously a powerful force that they did not fully anticipate, and yet by the early 1790s, people like James Madison were writing elegant op-eds, as it were, in the National Intelligencer on public opinion and its role in a Republican society. Or the politicization of the judiciary, something that's very controversial today. The fact that by the end of his second term, President Reagan will probably have appointed 50% of all the federal judges in this country, which is a very great number. That politicization of the judiciary may or may not be a good thing, but it would not surprise the founders, because if you recall, in 1800, when John Adams, or actually the, early in 1801, when John Adams was going out of office, he tried to pack the judiciary with Federalists as a way of preempting all the trouble that he thought the Jeffersonian Republicans would create. So I don't think the framers would be upset about those kinds of things, but I do think that there are at least four major sorts of developments that would upset them very much.
And, give me those very quickly.
They have to do with what's happened to the executive, to the Congress, and to the court, and ultimately to federalism. With respect to the executive, they would be utterly stupefied by the growth of the federal bureaucracy.
The power.
The bureaucracy in its scope and in its power goes far beyond anything that in their wildest dreams they might have imagined. Second, I think they would be very, very disappointed by the Congress in terms of its inertia. That congressmen fail to be bold and courageous because their eye is always on re-election. If we go back and look at the political careers of the founders themselves, almost all of them were defeated for re-election at various times. Madison was defeated when he ran for Congress during the 1780s. Jefferson was defeated and much criticized as a governor of Virginia. They felt that a person had to be a person of conviction and not make every political decision on the basis of whether it would wash with the voters. And I think that they would feel there's a real lack of integrity and leadership, particularly in the Congress.
There were no political pollsters in those days.
That's right. That's absolutely true. Third, I think that they'd be very surprised by the role of the Supreme Court, not because they would join in the cry against judicial usurpation or the court being too activist, but rather they would be shocked by the sheer amount of litigation that we have in our society, by the fact that our courts are so utterly congested. In the first years of its history, the Supreme Court was an incredibly underworked body. John Jay resigned as first Chief Justice in 1795 to run for governor of New York because he felt, I will never have any impact on this nation as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. It's a do-nothing job. And the founders would be just dumbfounded by the sheer workload that the court faces today. And it does mean that people tend to resolve to lawsuits in a way that is not necessarily part of the American tradition. Throughout the 17th and 18th centuries, people often went to private arbitrators. They did not take everything to court, and it's a massively expensive process, and the people who do well by it are the lawyers.
Right.
meanwhile, people languish in jail or out in bail for long periods of time waiting for their cases to be heard. And the fourth and final, and perhaps most important, phenomenon that would shock the founders if they could revisit us after 200 years is what's happened to federalism. And on this particular issue, the Attorney General has put his finger on something very important. The founders almost without exception described the system they created as partly national, partly federal. And they were very concerned about the distribution of sovereignty. And one of the reasons why this is the most brilliant, most creative moment in the entire history of American political thought was because they did innovate a new way of distributing sovereignty that they thought would make it possible for a government to work more smoothly and be more responsive to the needs of the people. And I think the founders would be very shocked by the imbalance that has occurred between the powers of the federal government and the relative weakness of state government today.
Michael Kamen is a professor at Cornell University. His book on the United States Constitution, A Machine That Would Go of Itself, won the Francis Parkman Prize at the 1987 meeting of the Society of American Historians. Michael Kamen recently participated in the Tocqueville Forum, a public policy lecture series sponsored by Wake Forest University. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Knowing the Constitution continues now with a conversation featuring another participant in the Tocqueville Forum at Wake Forest University. Joyce Appleby is a professor at the University of California at Los Angeles. Her books include Capitalism and a New Social Order, The Republican Vision of the 1790s, and Economic Thought and Ideology in 17th Century England.
Some of your professional colleagues, historians, have indicated in earlier editions of this program that the American people really don't know that much about the Constitution, that we're ignorant of the Constitution. What do you think of that proposition?
I don't really agree with that. I think it has a great deal to do with what you mean by the Constitution. If you mean, can, if you say, what's in Article 1, Section 8, can they bring it out of their memory? No. Or if you say, in which article do we find the Supreme Court's duties defined? No. In fact, I don't know that from one year to another. I look at the Constitution before I teach it, because that kind of memory or recall isn't necessary. That's why we have printed copies of the Constitution, like a dictionary or an encyclopedia. But at a much more profound level, I think the American people do know their Constitution, and they have a pretty good conception of what it means. It's just remarkable. I mean, we do have what I would call a culture of constitutionalism. People believe that it exists, it binds them, they think it plays a central role in guaranteeing not just their rights, but the kind of government they want. Let me give you an example. As a teacher, I have to think about what teaching involves, and one of the things I've come to realize is that we not only, at every level of education, but at the university where I teach, we not only give people new information, add to the contents of their mind, but almost as important, or maybe even more important, is the need to get each young man and woman to examine the contents that's already in their mind. And because of my interest in doing this, and because I teach the Constitution, I have many times given classes in introductory courses in American political history a Constitution that I have written.
Mm-hmm.
It's my Constitution, and it's a great Constitution. I really like it. It's very democratic. Everyone over the age of 18 can vote. Uh-huh. There are no states. Congress is divided up into proportional districts. There's a unicameral legislature and an elected president, no electoral college. It can be amended with majority vote. You can do everything with majority vote. It's a very simple constitution. I get.
And your object in all of this is what?
Well, my object in all of this is to get them to think about the constitution that we actually have by contrasting it. So. But what I do is I pass out this 8.5 by 11 sheet of my constitution a week in advance, and I ask the class to come the next week prepared to debate. They can take sides, either for my Constitution or they're for the United States Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there again is a sense that there is some objective truth that all people are going to affirm. I think that our truths are deeply held, but I think they arise from our experience, and one person's experience does differ from another.
Well, all of this variance in the interpretation of the Constitution, are we talking, therefore, about what we do to it, or are we talking about what's in the document itself?
I think with any text, with any conversation, this radio show that your listeners are, there is a relationship between the speaker and the hearer, the writer and the reader, and that is a unique relationship. Books do not read the same thing, read the same way to people. How often have you gone back to read a book, perhaps the Gospels or Plato's Republic or Pride and Prejudice? It is something that you treasure, and you read at different times in your life, and you'll say, my goodness, it's changed.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we're talking about is the whole problem amongst the historians and the political scientists of interpreting the Constitution, and that is to say the original intentions of the people who wrote it, of this body of 55 men who framed the Constitution.
Exactly.
Help me with this. We're supposed to look at it purely in terms of our contemporary problems, irrespective of the historical context and foundations out of which are...
No, I don't think so, because I think we have to recognize that we are the heirs of these 55 demigods, as Jefferson called them.
Right.
They have not only given us a document that has structured government in American society, but they've also given us a body of literature which has shaped the way in which we look at government and individual rights. So there is this constant negotiation or interaction between the past and the present. So it doesn't mean that we are ship sailing without ballast. We do have this ballast of a constitution, of two centuries of constitutional interpretations. But you cannot, it seems to me, break away from the fundamental fact that there is always an active interpretation going on. Let me give you another example. 2 years after the ratification of the Constitution, Hamilton wanted to have a bank, and he proposed a piece of legislation to incorporate a bank. James Madison was in the Congress. He said it was unconstitutional. Edmund Randolph had been in the Constitutional Convention. He thought it was unconstitutional. George Washington had been at the Constitutional Convention, actually, the presiding officer. He didn't know whether it was constitutional or not. Hamilton had been at the Constitutional Convention. He said it was constitutional.
Mm-hmm.
Four men, all participants, that summer of 1787, and they could not agree on the constitutionality of the bank bill.
Well, don't keep me in suspense here. Do we have a national bank? How did it happen?
Yes, we had a national bank. Jefferson thought that it was unconstitutional, and that was one of the prime reasons for his moving into opposition against the Washington administration and forming a great political movement.
Mm-hmm.
When he became president, because he thought the bank was unconstitutional, he allowed it to lapse.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what has happened in the intervening years is that we've learned a tremendous amount about the economy of the 17th and 18th centuries, and we're now aware of how really dazzling for those contemporaries the changes were. It didn't require an industrial revolution to astound people when there was no longer starvation from famine, or when there was a wonderful outpouring, a cascade of new things like pottery and
mm-hmm.
and utensils for eating and foods and calicoes, printed calicoes and cheap pamphlets. This was an amazing change in the material world, and I think it had a profound impact upon the way people thought about society. For instance, with classical republicanism, increasingly as the material world changed, as there were more goods, more food, more security, despite the fact that they seem very insecure when we look back, if they look back to the 15th and 16th centuries and it was a great deal more security, I think that provided the underpinnings for the liberalism that Jefferson displays, that is to say, the conviction that society has a spontaneous order. It doesn't require hierarchical authoritarian institutions.
That it's not fragile.
It's not fragile.
Mm-hmm.
It's solid. The opening lines of Common Sense start off with that society is created by our wants and government by our wickedness. Society unites our affections, whereas government is a creator of distinctions, and Paine opposes the two concepts. Well, this concept of society is a new 18th century concept, and it is the undergirding for a liberal politics in which power is limited and the ambit of free association is widened and protected. I think that's the way that capitalism, or the expanding free market economy, influenced politics at the end of the 18th century.
Is it an irony, Joyce Appleby, or is it a sort of natural kind of political evolution that we have developed the structure of American government as we know it, coming out of a mindset that was, what, suspicious of the many, placing the power in the few? Have I got that right?
Yes, absolutely. You're perfect. No, I don't think it's an irony at all, because it wasn't an unintended consequence. I think the way I describe the Constitutional Convention is that the men who gathered there, with very few exceptions, were nationalists. They wanted a national government.
Nationalists in contrast to?
The people who were concerned with state sovereignty, who were quite happy with the Articles of Confederation. Didn't bother them at all that there wasn't a strong national government.
Well, that would have left us with what? We would have existed as a bunch of separate nations, almost.
Separate states with a confederation. Uh-huh. Entirely possible arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
I don't agree at all with those people that think that we had to have a strong national government. I think those are alternatives. There are different goals that could be achieved by mm-hmm. keeping the Articles or by having a constitution.
Is this analogous to the talk that we hear coming out of Washington, regardless of whether it's Dwight Eisenhower or Ronald Reagan, about getting the government off the backs of the people?
No. Getting the government off the backs of the people came out of Jefferson, and that comes out of liberalism. That comes out of the belief that you don't need to have hierarchical institutions, that people can take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
This is where the locus of power is going to be. You can have a very powerful state government. Virginia could have had an oppressive state government. So the power that government exercises does not depend upon whether it's at the national level or at the state level. The power depends upon the political philosophy, whether there is a conviction, which is the liberal conviction, that government can be limited and that ordinary people can take care of themselves,
mm-hmm.
or the classical republican tradition, which is fearful of too large an ambit of personal freedom and wishes to structure mm-hmm. society more closely. Back to this question of history and the contents of mind, and the earlier example I gave you of the students with my constitution. One of the things that I have found fascinating year after year is not only that no one wants to discuss my constitution or defend it, but that they defend the United States Constitution in exactly the same language with the same logic that the Founding Fathers used.
Uh-huh.
Where do they get it? Here, I don't know.
Here we're talking not so much about politics as human nature.
Well, no, I don't think it is human nature. No, we're talking about that nest of symbols I talked about that culture of constitutionalism. These kids along the way, by the time they're 18, have absorbed the political logic of the American Constitution.
What are you telling me, that we need somehow or other to start earlier or to start in a different fashion?
No, I'm not saying anything. I'm merely adducing evidence to the proposition that the American public does know the Constitution when these young people can defend it the way Madison does, the way they defend bicameralism. You have to have two houses of a legislature. And I, of course, play the provocative questioner and ask them why. What are you protecting yourself from?
You're telling me that doing history is a way to think critically about yourself and about what you've inherited.
Yes. And in this case, when you asked me how a historian goes about doing things, I'm concerned about understanding why the Founding Fathers felt that you had to structure power in a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm interested in finding out why my students think that's appropriate to their world. And in the process, they learn about the 18th century, and I hope that I make them a little critical of some of the givens in their mind, open them up to thinking about the way of about the 20th century world. History is a dialogue, always a dialogue between the present and the past.
It's not a voice coming down monolithically
absolutely
from on
not
high.
If it is, I'm not plugged in, and I don't know who is.
Joyce Appleby, how should we celebrate our Constitution? We have a bicentennial commission. We've got a lot of money being spent locally, regionally. Had your druthers, what kind of a...
If I had my druthers, I suppose I would like to see us all gather in groups of 20, 25 around the country and thrash out just these questions.
Mm-hmm.
What was the framers' intent? So what that they intended this or that? What is our intention? What is this culture of constitutionalism? I think there's a big difference between one's being imbued with a set of notions that are unexamined and one adhering to convictions which have been examined and affirmed. And I'd like to see us go from the unexamined assumptions to the confirmed convictions about power and politics in general and our institutions in particular. So I guess that I would love to see convened seminars. And I use the word seminars because I think people learn when they themselves are talking, not when they listen to other people.
Joyce Appleby teaches at the University of California at Los Angeles. She's the recipient of the Berkshire Prize for Women Historians. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Knowing the Constitution, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about American secondary education. My guests will be Thomas Kane, Governor of New Jersey, and Mark Tucker, Director of the Carnegie Forum on Education and the Economy. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for a program about the bicentennial of the United States Constitution. How well do Americans know their principal governing document? Replies to that question from two prominent historians, Michael Kamen of Cornell University and Joyce Appleby of the University of California at Los Angeles. Knowing the Constitution, some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station,